I'm going to call the meeting to order. We obviously don't have a quorum, but given the weather, I don't necessarily expect a quorum, particularly after listening to Representative Doty's horror stories and getting here. I am hoping that people go slow and get here in good shape. So, but we are going to start, and we'll call a quorum when we have enough members. With that, welcome to Marty Vadas, and you're going to continue with Lands and Minerals.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that if you recall, we made it a few slides into this last time, so if it's right, I would skip forward to where we stopped.
That would be fine. Do you have a new handout for us? I think we'll wait until members have that. Would you tell us which one you're going to start with?
It's number five.
All right. Please proceed.
Yeah, and on this slide, we were talking about mine land reclamation, and target of 500 acres per year permanently reclaimed land and 2,000 acres of stabilized land. But there was a question of, what does that mean? What's the context of that? And for this slide, and this relates to taconite reclamation, there's 250,000 acres of land that's under permit to mine to six taconite operations.
Can you repeat that again?
There's 250,000 acres of land that's under permit, permit to mine, which is a DNR reclamation permit, to six taconite operations. And most of that is buffer land for these operations. There's actually about 70,000 acres of land that's disturbed by mining. And of that amount, about half is in tailings basins. And that's the area where the fine ground up rock is deposited. And about half of the remaining is in taconite pits. And most of those pits will become water filled, so the reclamation really revolves around the edge of those pits. And the remaining land is located in stockpiles. And so the tailings basins tend not to grow in size. They tend to grow up because more tailings are deposited. And each year, about 200 to 700 acres of new land is disturbed by mining. And about 500 acres per year is permanently abandoned. And the difference year to year really depends on what's going on. If a pit is being expanded or a stockpile is being expanded, it would be, more or less any one particular year. And the 2,000 acres of stabilization really is in the tailings basins. And it's about 19,000 acres that are contained in tailings basins. Most of the basin is filled with water, but there are certain portions of it that are unvegetated and uncovered with water, and so they tend to create dust unless there's some vegetation on them. So each year about 2,000 acres is permanent or temporarily vegetated to prevent that. So I hope that kind of helps with those 500 to 2,000 acre numbers mean.
If I could follow up on that, that is then the responsibility of the mining companies, and that is not a public responsibility?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Let's ask the question, are there lands that have previously been abandoned that need to be reclaimed? And are there other, let's start with that question.
Madam Chair, the wildland reclamation law became effective in 1980. And so any mining that's taken place since that time is under the reclamation law, so they need to meet the standards. There are unreclaimed stockpiles and mine pits that are pre-1980. And actually, the Iron Range Resources has responsibility and a program to do reclamation on pre-1980 mining. And one other point is that as the taconite mines expand, they consume some of the old mining areas. So each year, about 80 acres of previously mined land is mined through by taconite plants, taconite pits and stockpiles, and so those are effectively reclaimed as the modern mining takes place.
The taconite isn't the only thing that is mined. I mean, we're mining a lot more gravel now. How are we doing on reclamation with current and then anything that's pre-1980? I assume it's under the same law.
Madam Chair, gravel mining is not regulated on a statewide basis. It's regulated on a county-by-county basis, so it's really the county that sets the standard for reclamation of gravel pits. The exception to that is if the state-owned land, DNR for about 20 years has been requiring a reclamation or restoration plan for any state-owned gravel pits that are mined. So it's really the county that has the authority and jurisdiction to require reclamation for gravel mining.
So do the counties report to you and tell you what the status of mining and reclamation is?
Madam Chair, they do not. DNR did about 20 years ago put together sort of a best management practices handbook for gravel mining to try to assist county planning and zoning with different techniques that could be used to reclaim gravel pits for future use or to stabilize them.
As we are talking about there's public pressure for us to deal with getting our waters back up to par, is gravel mining on a local level part of a problem, or is it, in your view, no problem at all?
Well, Madam Chair, I believe the answer to that is if there's gravel near a water course, there's probably special techniques and buffering that you would really want to do to protect that water body. And most instances, that's not an issue, but from time to time, there is gravel mining near streams or lakes or whatever. And how big a problem that is, I guess, it would be difficult to quantify, but those would be the areas that you want to be the most concerned about, in my view.
So we have no statewide standards for mining near water bodies, is what I'm getting here.
Madam Chair, there are some standard setbacks from wild and scenic rivers, for example, but to my knowledge, there's no statewide setback for gravel mining from water bodies, no.
That point,
Manager. Yeah, I have several questions. Representative Anslight first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late.
Don't. This is a hard morning.
Mr. Vitas, I'm really interested in the working relationship and the delineation of responsibilities between Iron Range Resources and the Department of Natural Resources. Could you give us just a brief snapshot of just who's responsible for what in this area of reclaiming mine land? And as you know from our previous discussion, I am very interested in an outcome relative to the Canisteo reclamation, and it is reclamation. And I'm interested in getting at an outcome that everybody can be pleased with and satisfied with regarding that project. And I'm struggling with that. And one of my concerns is the relationship between your agency and Iron Range Resources.
Madam Chair, Representative Benzelk, I think I can explain that by, in 1969, the first mine land reclamation law was passed in Minnesota, and that law was, really had no authority. Had no teeth to it. So there were subsequently additional laws that were passed that required reclamation. And rules were written, so in 1980, every taconite operation in Minnesota had to be under a permit to mine. And so since 1980, there have been laws in place and rules that regulate the taconite mining. And so from that point forward, the Department of Natural Resources has been responsible for the active mining and the reclamation. And pre-1980 mining is really under the authority of the Iron Range Resources, and they, IRRR, IRRR, has a program to do reclamation, and they have done a tremendous amount of work on the Iron Range trying to restore some of the former mine lands.
Just a real quick follow-up.
Representative Ansel.
So, responsibility for the degradation of the iron ore formation, the ground, the environment, the area in which people live and live very near, mining that took place prior to 1980, reclaiming that land and water is the responsibility of Iron Range Resources.
Madam Chair, Representative Denzel, I think the answer to that is a yes, in that the companies that mined before that were really under no state law, no regulation to reclaim in any particular manner or fashion. And it was only after that point that they became responsible and needed to meet standards for reclamation.
Thanks.
Representative Mull.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the point to the point that you raised prior to Representative Anzels. You said Representative Chair Wagenius was talking about there's no standard or question if there was a standard for gravel mining or setbacks, you know, to wetlands or bodies of water. In particular, and this is a case in point, in Wilton, Minnesota, you're probably aware of this, there's an application for expansion of a gravel mine, essentially taking the top off a hill, Wilton Hill, down below the water line, adjacent to County Park. Apparently, I don't know if you've issued a statement saying they have to have an EIS or a worksheet. My understanding is it's just a worksheet. So perhaps you could use this example to explain to us the process that you would go through to protect a natural, scenic area of significance for a community.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, I think what you're referring to is in Wilton, Minnesota, up near west of Bemidji.
Right.
There is an existing gravel pit, and actually that pit is on state-owned land. It's forestry-acquired land, and there's a proposal to expand that gravel mining to and it would really consume a hill of gravel in that area. And so,
excuse me, Madam Chair, it's not a hill of gravel, it's a forested hill.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. It is a forested hill. And so, Department of Natural Resources did conduct an environmental, an EAW, on that. And that was just recently complete. And there has not been a determination yet whether or not that EAW is adequate or whether there would be an EIS that would be done on the site. It's my understanding that decision might be coming in the next few weeks. And that would be the process that would be taken for that particular example. And I do know that I've been to that site, and it is across the road from a lake, and so in a reclamation plan for that one, you certainly would want to take into account where the water goes and to protect and buffer so that that doesn't go directly into that water body.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, when you're going through this process now, whether an EIS would full EIS would be required, are you taking into account the significance of the aesthetic significance of this site, the fact that it does have a proximity to a lake that's being used for recreation purposes? That the proposed mining, gravel mining, is going to bring the level of that hill down several hundred feet. And frankly, if for those of you who don't know where I live, there's not a lot of hills. It's one of three. Down below the waterline, essentially in a West Virginia style, removing the hill from the topography. I mean, you're taking into account these things in your determination.
Madam Chair, Representative, that the EAW and the EIS question is really being worked through our regional office in Bemidji, and I do know that there were many comments directed at the kind of thing that you're describing in the EAW process. And it is, in my view, great local significance, the issue that you're raising. And I don't know what the outcome will be or what the answer will be on that. But, I'll just point out that any time there's a gravel development or a mine development, it's not a popular thing. I mean, it means noise and dust and traffic and hours of operation and that kind of thing. The other side of it is that, as we'll see in a slide a little later on, there is and continues to be a growing demand for aggregate across the state. And so it's a difficult issue. But the one that you're raising, I think, is, in my view, a particularly difficult one because of the significance that you're raising for the area.
If I could follow up on your question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a quick statement. I anxiously await your agency's determination.
When you are, I know you look at the quantity of groundwater, and apparently this is going to have some disturbance in the groundwater. How do you interface with the PCA rules that say no degradation of groundwater? Is that part of what you are considering as you're considering representative the project in Representative Moe's district?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that that particular operation would not go below the water table. But having said that, there are other operations that, in western Minnesota especially, that have gone below the water table. And those would be in more in Clay County. And in those instances, DNR has conducted groundwater studies to determine the effects on things like calcareous bends in the area, trying to determine what that operation, what kind of impact that would have on those kinds of features in the area.
There's always, beyond a quantity question of DNR, there's the quality question of PCA as you're affecting groundwater. But I think we need to continue.
Thank you. With this slide, I think what we wanted to talk about was another sort of high-level outcome for DNRs to meet fiduciary responsibilities for trust fund lands. And DNR is working to try to increase the revenue for school trust lands. The target for the current biennium was to exchange about 3,000 acres of school trust land that are in management, DNR management units, where they can't produce revenue, and these are in state parks. And the outcome for this biennium is that there will be exchanges of almost about 4,900 acres of school trust fund lands out of state parks. And when that's complete, there will be no school trust lands in state parks or recreation areas that aren't currently generating revenue. And so That will complete exchanging lands out of state parks. There remains school trust fund land in places like scientific and natural areas and water access sites and so forth. So there's more opportunity to remove those lands and put them into a status where they can generate revenue. And we would intend to move forward and continue with that in the future. Just one other thing I'll mention. Have also we've received an appropriation to work on these kinds of things. Another one is inventory for aggregate on trust fund land, and so we have been working on that as well. And also have an RFP out looking at a few parcels of trust fund land, looking at the best ways to try to generate income off of those with regard for the natural resources in the area. In addition to managing mineral activities and the fiduciary responsibilities, the Lands and Minerals Division also manages all of DNR's real estate transactions. And this work really does help meet the DNR's overall land management goals, and it has specific targets found in the DNR's conservation agenda, which I believe you have copies of. And so these are just some statistics on sort of what's been accomplished in this area, this current biennium, and just to give you some idea that acquisition number, I believe that's the largest amount ever that DNR has received for the acquisition of fee and easement interest in things like wildlife management areas and so forth. I think in the past, the largest amount has been more on the order of $20 million for a biennium. So this is represented as a substantial increase in what's been accomplished. The next slide, I think, just is useful to understand in what's going on in the minerals world. This graph illustrates the trends for some pricing on a few metals. And what we have on this graph is the price for copper, zinc, iron, and nickel over the last few years. And if you were to look at many, many other commodities, gold or platinum or palladium or rhodium or more or less any metal that you can think of, there would be a similar picture. And really, this is affecting Minnesota in that there really is a worldwide demand for these kinds of metals. And so we're seeing an increase in exploration activity here in our state, and also a very strong iron mining industry in the state as well. For example, I think this biennium, there have been 120 exploration drill holes so far. And that is about four times more drill holes than we had during the last biennium. And so we are seeing, as many other places in the world are, an increase in demand for metals, and also strong interest in exploring for them as well.
I look at these things, and when folks are talking about the controversy about mining for sulfides, and I think I may not have the word right there, which of these ores are they talking about? What are they after?
Madam Chair, that would be what's sort of called, as a general class, base metals, things like copper, nickel, and zinc. And those minerals are almost always in nature in the form of sulfide minerals. Copper, for example, anywhere in the world where it is mined, somewhere in the history of that copper deposit, sulfur was involved, and it's really a key element in accumulating those metals to the point where you have an ore deposit and you can mine them. And so, Madam Chair, there is a great discussion going on, because in Minnesota there is a proposal by a company called Polymet Mining to open a copper and nickel and platinum deposit just south of the Iron Range, and that would be the first ever sulfide mine in Minnesota. And that deposit is different than the iron mining, in that the iron mines contain a little bit of sulfur, but very little. where these base metal mines often, well, almost always contain a higher level of sulfur.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Thank you. And thank you, Director Vadas, for walking us through the lands and minerals priority measures and outcomes. As you can see, their work touches a lot of things that the department does, and a lot of acres and a lot of important issues that we deal with as we look at some of our fiduciary responsibilities, especially dealing with trust. One thing, a couple kind of housekeeping things here. I'm handing out a table of contents for your fact sheets, if you can put this on top of them. As you recall, last time we handed out the department's fact sheets, I'll be working off of these as we talk through the change items. They do provide more context than some of the fact pages of your budget book, so I'll be using those to go through our change items. And also, I'm in the process of scheduling meetings with all the members on the committee to answer detailed questions that you may have on a budget or other DNR related questions. So if you can jot things down, we can talk about it one on one, or we can talk about it in front of the committee, whatever you wish. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to talk about the change items.
Representative Bill.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius. Mr. Meyer, Mr. Vadas, on the trust land that's in the parks, SNAs and so on and so forth, when they're in there, but I understand you're trading them out. Does the school trust receive remuneration from the department or from the state in compensation for what we would normally get if they weren't in state parks?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, how this is being handled is it's a land exchange.
Well, no, I mean the remaining land. After you do the exchanges, you said there'll be some additional land that's left in the SNAs, etc. The land that's left or the land that's there today, or does the school trust receive any money for that presently?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, the school trust receives no income from those lands.
So the park and the people are the beneficiary of the use of the land in the school trust, but there isn't anything forthcoming to the school kids. So that
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, in the case of the state parks, we will have accomplished exchanging all the land out of state parks that had trust fund status, and so that's taken care of. There is some remaining land in the Hillanic State Park, but actually, there are four mineral leases to Minnesota Steel, and so those are generating income, and the establishment of that park did allow for that, and so you can generate income there. And also on the Cuyuna Recreation Area, there's some school trust lands, but same story. Those lands are capable of generating income. I think the other ones you're talking about, scientific and natural areas, they do not.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, I just want to make sure I understood it. And thank you I know that that's been a goal of our. We have a high propensity of school trust lands in our area, and that's been a goal of ours to get to accomplish what you're doing, so thank you.
Madam Chair, back to change items. If you go to page 19 of your fact sheets, first change item I'd like to discuss is the mineral management account. The mineral management account was established last biennium as a way to capture some of the costs for managing of these lands, as the vast work that Lands and Minerals does related to minerals activities throughout the state to generate income. The land types that we have, permanent school trust, permanent university trust, and acquired lands, we have to manage the assets differently. Similar to what we established with the forest management investment account to capture our management costs from the money that we're generating off the land, this initiative was set up to do that with the minerals activities, taking certain revenues off of those receipts or the profits, if you want to look at it that way, and deposit them into accounts for us to use to manage the activities. The governor's budget proposes to go back to having the general fund fund mineral management activities next year. There's a current balance in the account because of the way the account was set up. We would like to capture that balance to do the minerals activities this year, and then the fund will sunset, and then it will be a general fund appropriation next year. So, if you go,
trying to figure out how to get you to the right numbers the best way possible here. The numbers that we're looking at are going to be $3 million for the first year, 2008, and then it'll be a general fund appropriation of $2,896,000 for the second year of the biennium. So this proposal will sunset the minerals management account, take us back to the way of doing business before the minerals management account was established. The reason for this is there were a number of... the university was one of the main concerns. It didn't have a lot of comfort level with this idea. It did allow us to accelerate a lot of our activities related to minerals management, and the balances that we put forward in those counts, I think, as Director Vedas talked about, were record numbers, over $20 million in a one-year loan. So we thought it was a good return for the money, but now due to the concerns that other people have had, we're recommending that this go away and we go back to the old way of managing these activities.
With regard to your management, I mean, I understand your position with regard to how you're funding going from that account to the general fund, thanks to some good tutoring by Mr. Reinholz. Within the money you have in this group, do you provide any subsidies to people who are getting permits from you, or do the people who ask for permits pay the full cost of the permitting process?
Madam Chair, the groups asking for the permits pay the full cost. For example, in the case of environmental review, it's a mandatory EIS for a new mineral development, and the companies pay for the engineering studies and so forth, but they also pay for the state agencies to review those EIS applications. So there's an income agreement from each of them for environmental review where they need to pay for the cost of state government employees and contractors to work on this.
A good plan. Yeah. Representative Bill.
Thank you, Chair Reganius. Do they, as I recall, in the case of PolyMet, I think it's PolyMet, they had to put up like a $5 million bond or some amount of money up front as a deposit that the department held or the state held for a period of time while you did your work? Or there was some big number that they talked about as a commitment. Maybe it was Masaba Nugget that was talking about that. I don't remember. But one of those, they had to put up a big number, like $5 million. And what, Director, what tell us how that works?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I believe what you're referring to is a bond that was required by the Pollution Control Agency for the Masabi Nugget project. And that was related to the disposal system that they were proposing. And it was just to ensure that if it didn't work the way it was planned, there was money at hand available to remediate that. And today's reclamation rules do require in taconite mining that there be financial assurance so that frankly the public doesn't pay if there needs to be something remediated in the future. And the same is true for polymet, a sulfide type operation. There needs to be ahead of time financial assurance, that whether that's a bond or a letter of credit, something where the goal is it can't be extinguished through bankruptcy. The state can access that with no other approvals or requirements. It's money that would be available to solve problems should there be problems in the future.
He has a follow-up, and I want to compliment you on that process. That's what saved us when we had to deal with all the closed landfills. Yes, Representative Phil.
So then, thank you, Chair Reganius. So what, does that then go on in perpetuity? Let's take the Oliver Mining Company, if they existed today, and they would have done the same thing. Then does that protect the state then indefinitely? How does that work? It would seem that if a company decided to cease operations or it did go bankrupt, you said that the letter of credit or the insurance policy or the cash bond outlives the bankruptcy. But what if they just decide that it's not any longer, they close the mine, LTV as an example. How does that lay out in terms of the state's assurance, the taxpayers, the public's assurance that our interests are protected.
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, LTV might be a good example in that they are under a closure plan right now. And so Cleveland Cliffs, who is the current owner, is moving along, doing final reclamation on that site. And they can eventually apply for a release from their permit to mine. And at that point, if the state is convinced that all the reclamation has been done and that it's successful and there are no future issues that would come up from that operation, they could be released from that permit to mine, and at that point they could be released from the requirements of their bond, but that's a decision the state gets to make.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, but I'm going another pot. That made me think of... So let's just assume then, Director, that there was no Cleveland Cliffs, that Cleveland Cliffs came in after the bankruptcy and bought up those assets for a song, so to speak. Dana Byrne might disagree with that. But let's just say there was, in that instance, no Cleveland Cliffs and all there was the public. How would that play out, the bond into the future for maybe decades to come as it's decided what is the remediation?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, we have each of these operations under financial assurance of some form now, and we would not release that to another operator unless or until we're convinced that the other operator would have sufficient financial assurance to take on those responsibilities. So in other words, we got somebody on the hook right now. We're not going to let that group off and let somebody else come in unless that group coming in can also demonstrate that they can perform and that they have the financial assurance to make sure that the work is done in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Some of the primary activities, just quickly, that the minerals management activities that funding will provide is to allow the department to continue our primary minerals management responsibilities, continue the state industry investments to fund research to diversify the industry, reduce processing costs, and the reclamation activities that the director spoke of. Just quickly, this graph is also in your slides. It shows the mineral activity that we have, projections, and looking forward. So
if I could just mention on this slide, the estimate for fiscal 07 was done many, many months ago. And actually how this is playing out is for this fiscal year, the income is likely to be, we're on track for $26 million of income. And also those projections for the future, if the escalators keep going up, are likely to be perhaps a little low as well. And really are on track in the next 4 years to collect about $100 million of mineral income from just the current operations. That would be without Minnesota Steel or some of the other operations that are proposed. Those also have some state-owned land under lease, and if they're successful in getting their permits and starting to operate, it would represent another potential source of mineral revenue for the state.
You can see just very quickly on the slide as well, the amounts that go to the blue is the permanent school fund, and the salmon color there is the permanent university fund. So these activities are very important to funding those institutions as well. And it's critical that we keep our investments in this division to do this activities to maintain those levels of returns. The land asset management change item, as I spoke last time we met, we have a number of DNR budget reallocations. It's the actual first page of your fact sheets here. As we built our budget from the ground up, going through each individual component of the funding throughout the division, or the department, I should say, we were able to reallocate, reprioritize some of the funding. This $860 represents one of those building blocks that we reprioritized to continue to do the activities that we're dealing with right now. Large and more expeditious exchanges. Turnaround time is very important to our customers in providing that quality service that we need to do. And then there's the strategic planning for acquisition, use, and disposition. As we talked about our exchanges of land, things of that nature, we have a lot more of that work to do. Our real estate, day-to-day land asset management are funded by this program here. G you can see on that page, as we talked about here, the productivity increases we hope to gain from this funding source. One of the things that we talked about a little bit previously is the aggregate mapping, an activity that we need to continue with is our accelerated county aggregate mapping activities. This slide will show you where we're at with that, with completed by MGS. I'm not sure what that is.
Minnesota Geological Survey.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
In progress and where we're at with counties. You can see St. Louis County has requested us to come in and help with them, help them complete these types of activities to map their aggregates so we know where the most beneficial places are where we can get these materials. As you may be aware, the aggregate mining industry is based upon need, quantity, and distance to the place where it's needed. So it's really becomes a local issue when they need an aggregate source.
And maybe just mention that graph on the right. It just shows that the consumption of construction aggregates in Minnesota over the years, and really more than half of that is purchased by public agencies for roads and public infrastructure. And so public funding goes in to pay for most of this aggregate that's used. And the projection is that trend will continue on into the future. And I just mentioned one other thing that we're working on and very interested in, and that's using some of the stockpile material from former iron mining operations for this purpose. And the idea would be, the goal is to not disturb new lands, but to try to use that existing stockpile disturbed material and supply this aggregate need. And the issue that comes down to is the quality is good, it's just the distance from markets. But it's something we're quite interested in for the kind of thing that Representative Moe was referring to earlier. It's just very difficult to get these kinds of operations permitted in many places in the state.
When you say the quality is good, then we don't have any worries about contamination from asbestos or anything like that as it moves off-site?
Madam Chair, there is an area on the eastern part of the Mesabi Range where there are some restrictions for what that material can be used for. There aren't those same concerns on sort of most of the rest of the Mesabi Range, so there aren't those kinds of minerals that could potentially cause some of those concerns. And really, the iron mining wastes are silica, oxygen, and iron, and so they're very benign as far as any leaching or that sort of thing, and the quality of the material for construction purposes is very good.
That's good to hear. On the other side, where there are restrictions, what is the issue there?
Madam Chair, I think we all remember that famous case, the reserve mining case from many years ago, and one potential issue that was debated was the mineral fibers. And so the geology is such that on the eastern end of the Mesabi Range, it's different than on the western end, and there are mineral fibers, and debate continues on, you know, what the health effects of those might or might not be. And so that a decision was made by MnDOT and also through some actions of the court that material just wouldn't be used for that purpose. And so that remains till today.
You want to continue?
Continuing forward, too fast. The next slide, we talked about this briefly. This describes, and you can look at it as your reference, all the activities in the lands, public lands and waters administered by the DNR. 5.5 million acres of land, 12 million acres of land that have mineral rights on there, 58 state forests, 11,000 lakes, 69,000 miles of rivers and streams. This past summer, we sat down as a senior management team and with the regional directors and went through the state, visiting each of our regions and looking at the critical trends and needs out throughout the state. And as we prepared our budget, one thing kept coming to the top is our needs for an updated land record management system. The intensifying pressures that we see regarding land use, mineral interest, as we've discussed here, land record information, so we can make sure we know where the property lines are, where these easements and other activities that we're entering into lie, where snowmobile trails lie.
inventories of state lands. We need to, we took a step back and looked at what other states have, what we have right now. And if you remember back about 20 years ago, the old 286 computers with the DOS screens, and that's kind of what we're running our land record system on right now. I'd love to have you folks over to give you a tour firsthand of our land record system. While it is adequate for us, it provides our needs. We have a limited number of staff in the department that actually know how to operate and access this system. We need to develop something more like your counties have, for example, that have the ability to go in and if you look at a county website now, you can search a property ID number, pull up aerial photos, pull up plat map pictures, do detailed historical searches of deed assessments, things of that nature. This is the kind of system that we need to move into, working with the counties that are out there, assuring that we have adequate information exchange. Our information technology staff is working with folks to make sure that the information we have is compatible and that we aren't duplicating a lot of things that are out there. What we're trying to do, we've issued an RFP right now to get our hands around the cost, and that will be back very shortly. But what we're doing is reallocating internally and asking for some new money to do this process. You'll see on the fact sheets here, on page one actually, on the budget reallocation side, there's a land record management system general fund reallocation. They'll provide $629,000 to support the development of the lands and minerals management system. We're also asking for $701,000 that'll be reallocated from other internal funds. $326,000 from the Game and Fish Fund, $20,000 from the Water Rec account, $11,000 from the Snowmobile account, $344,000 from the Forest Management Investment account. These numbers are based upon the needs and the activities that these actual accounts, or these divisions, I should say, where the funds are deposited, need. For example, the Game and Fish Fund, looking at our wildlife management areas, our aquatic management areas, making sure we can enforce, protect, and operate them in the best way possible. Look at our landowners. Our Working Lands Initiative, as you'll hear in a couple weeks or a couple days, hopefully, we'll rely on this data in the future to help us make it more productive. As we go into what I envision, the state lands being examples of where we can produce high-quality biofuel stocks, these types of information will help us to predict yields, possibly, predict where we should be managing these types of activities. Much as farmers now use GIS applications for soil types and things of that nature, we'll be able to hopefully have layers that will show us how we can make our lands more productive, manage them more effectively.
Mr. Meyer,
yes, ma'am.
You listed a internal reallocation. Now, my book is set up differently than the list you've given me, so help me out. Is there a list of this internal reallocation of the list of figures you just gave me?
Madam Chair, if you go to page 3 of your fact sheets,
okay,
it's titled Land Records Management System.
Okay.
And then you need to go to page 1. It also talks, page 1 talks about the $629,000 that we've reallocated internally through our building block process. And then the actual fact sheet discusses the $701,000, which we've tapped into, or I shouldn't say tapped into, which we're asking for the authority to use money from these dedicated accounts to fund part of this project as well. It's really, as we went through our process building the budget, we came up with a lot of priorities, but two that really came to the top was the need for a highly developed and new land record management system, and also the Clean Water Legacy activities that we're going to discuss here in a few days with Ecological Services. So out of everything that we have a lot of priorities, as you know, but these two rose to the top, and that's why we've reallocated a lot of internal funds to do this. We aren't asking for a lot of new money right now, knowing the pressures that everyone has, but we feel if it's a priority to us, we need to make sure we figure out how to fund it. So that's what the reallocation piece comes from.
So this is like $1.3 million or $1.4 million, given that. How far will you get in the process of managing your lands records?
It's going to be a multi-year process, and if we want to get into a more detailed discussion, I probably should bring down Robert Mackey from our materials or our management resources division.
And rather than doing that, unless people have questions about that right now, it would be good to see how you project out over 4, 6, 8 years and how long it will take to complete this process.
Madam Chair, I do have a little bit of that information we can talk about. The total funding request for this biennium is $1.6 million a year. Of that, we're asking for $701,000 from the three accounts that I talked about per year. Forest Management Investment Account, Game and Fish, Water Rec, Snowmobile. Our reprioritized general fund change item, $629,000 a year, and that comes from $500,000 from forestry, $58,000 from parks, $48,000 from ecological services, $20,000 from trails and waterways, and $3,000 from waters for a total of $629,000. And then in the minerals management base, they're taking, reprioritizing $270,000 out of their base as part of a larger budget item. We're anticipating the needs in the next biennium to be roughly $900,000 per year at this point in time. As we refine this process, as we get closer to the end of session, I hope to come back with more a more concrete timeline for you. But right now, we're anticipating the total budget for the project over 4 years to be roughly $5 million.
And after 4 years and $5 million, will it be complete?
By the end of fiscal year 09, we'll have finished the redesign work, database designs, and application prototypes. The following biennium, we'll deploy the new system, train the users, and then it'll be available to the public as well once we get everything worked out, all the kinks worked out of it. So it is a multi-biennial process. But, I would like to work with the Madam Chair and the staff to get folks over there if you're at all interested, because it is a high priority for us and the needs that we have out there are great. But also, the process, once it's developed, will help us do our work, but also will allow you to become desktop experts, if you want to call it, on all the lands that we have out throughout the state. Any other questions on that before I move on? Just to summarize, the other thing, let me just touch really quickly because we're going to get to it in a second here. You're going to see in your fact sheets as well on page 5 a fact sheet called Operation Support Reallocation. After we get done with the divisions, we're going to touch on these reallocations a little bit more. But as we've done in the past, we've tried to make sure that divisions are fully aware of the activities that they want to do, the workloads that they place on other people within our division, or our department, I should say. What this initiative will do, we're actually going through and reallocating operation support dollars back to the division, so then they will use these dollars to buy the services that they need. Much like we did with the facilities management account several years ago. This initiative will raise the awareness of agency program managers and hold them accountable for program costs. So they'll be coming back and working with our information education, our human resources, management budget services in a more aware manner, as now these will become actually activities that they need to fund out of their budgets as well. It helps our managers and our division directors become more aware of how the whole budget kind of works together. So you'll be seeing this in each of the budget discussions as we talk forward, the operation support. We'll summarize that in a little bit more detail for you in the end here. Just to close with lands and minerals, this is what we're looking at for the FY08-09 budget. You can see the general funds, $41.1 million or 61.7%, is pilt payments. So it's a big portion of what we have there. Natural Resources Fund, $4 million, Special Revenue, $2.2 million, small piece of Game and Fish and other funds. And then the other general fund, non-built general fund payments are about $16 million. So just as we move forward, I want to make sure you're going to see a line item at some point in time that will say General Fund, Lands and Minerals of about $57 million. And then $41 million of that will be for payments in lieu of tax. So I just want to make sure people keep that in the back of your mind, that they don't say, wow, it's lands and minerals with all the general fund money, but it's going back to your counties for the land tax
that we work with them on. Do you have any questions on lands and minerals at all while we wrap up here?
If we're ready to wrap up and move on to the next.
Thank you very much. Just a summary table is on your on the back page of your handout there, outlining all the programs that we've had. And I think, Madam Chair, once we get all done, I'll have one sheet for you to work off of that will have by division these pages so people can just maybe put them right in their book there.
Sure.
Now I need to see. I think I can do this.
Well, while you are changing here, I am going to call the meeting to formally to order because we have had a quorum and ask Representative Hansen if he would move the minutes, move approval of the minutes of January 25, 30, and February 1st.
I move the minutes of each of those meetings.
Any questions, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, members, moving into Parks and Recreation, Cortland Nelson was going to be with us today. Unfortunately, he's not able to be here, so we have the next best thing. Chuck Hartack, our Assistant Division Director, here to walk through us with the presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Chuck Hartack. I've worked in the state park system for 34 years, but I'm completely new to this process. I've been the Deputy Director for about 8 months. So as you look at the handout, I'll begin going through the presentation. The first slide deals with our fiscal year 06 and 07 direct, open, and statutory appropriations. And you can see that 48% of that is derived from the general fund, and 35% is made up of the natural resource fund. And the largest component of that natural resource fund is our natural resource state park dedicated account, and this accounts for about $20 million of that total. Another large portion of that, the natural resource fund is our lottery in lieu of, and that amounts to about 3.6 or close to $4 million each year. The mission of the Division of Parks and Recreation is to work with the citizens of the state to protect and manage our natural, cultural, and scenic resources for present and future generations while providing appropriate recreational opportunities and conservation education activities. We currently manage 67 state parks, 6 state recreation areas, 8 state waysides, 1 state trail, and since 2001 we've managed 54 state forest recreation areas, which include campgrounds and day use areas. You can see our attendance trends. They fluctuate. We're a very weather dependent business, and you can see some of the fluctuations are related to weather. We've had some poor winters where our winter use is significantly down. One of the bright spots is that our, if you look at the campers, that total since 2004 is on the increase. And while much of the per capita outdoor recreational participation in the state is declining, from 2004 to 2015, there are some bright spots, and there's going to be an increased demand, 15% more camping opportunities, and hiking and jogging is also up 7%, and 86% of our campers and state parks use hiking trails. Some of the trends, of course, population is aging.
Pardon? Just a second. In your bright spots, you said you went a little fast there for
okay.
me to write it down, but I don't see it written down, but it would be helpful. One of the trends up is jogging and hiking.
Yes, that's a survey that looked at outdoor recreation participation from 2004 to 2014. And over that period, there are only 3 activities that were increasing per capita. One was camping, an expected 15% increase. One was hiking, jogging, and that was in the neighborhood of 7%. And then the other outdoor recreation was OHV use, which is up significantly. Population, of course, is more urban and suburban, and technology is just critically important to us. We now have 6.5 million hits annually on our state park web pages, so we're going to expand and improve our technology. Minnesota state parks have been referred to as the windows of Minnesota, everyone's country, estate, and timeless treasures. And we're uniquely positioned, being almost at the center of the North American continent, where three continental watersheds come together in three distinct biomes. This provides us with lots of opportunities to protect and manage biodiversity, as well as providing diverse recreational opportunities. One healthcare professional said that parks and trails have the ability to do something that a $1 billion healthcare industry cannot do. So the benefits of state parks are numerous, from personal, individual, physical, and mental well-being, as well as social, environmental, and economic benefits. And the economics, depending on what survey is being looked at, upwards of $300 million is injected into the economy because of our state park system. This next slide is just a summary of the categories that we'll be reviewing individually as we move forward in the presentation. The broad priority outcomes that we look at are natural resources, protection and management, cultural and historic features, providing diverse natural-based recreational opportunities, our conservation education programs, which involves our interpretive and naturalist programs, and overall maintaining a 95% customer satisfaction rate for state park visitors. Moving into our natural resource protection and management area, you can see that we currently manage over 13,000 acres of state parks on an annual basis. And since 2004, we've accumulated some totals here for you. 2,200 acres of prairie forest and wetland restoration, invasive species control on 18,000 acres, and this coming spring up in northwest Minnesota, we've had a very aggressive program dealing with buckthorn removal in our northwest region parks, and we'll be celebrating and cutting down the last buckthorn plant that's located in northwest region parks, so that's a significant accomplishment for us. Rare species and resource inventories. Our state parks contained 280 endangered, threatened, and special species concerns, such as cerulean warblers and Dakota skippers and Blanding's turtles, and on and on. We've currently mapped about 80% of our state parks' land cover mapping, and this is critical for us to establish desired future conditions upon which we will manage our natural resources. And we're our management efforts relate to restoring the landscape to pre-settlement conditions, or representing a vignette of primitive America.
Question from Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up your land cover mapping question. So, in general, you know where what plants are or where they're at on the state parks.
About 80% of the ground we have land cover mapped. We have done completed inventories for bird and fish species, but not other species at this point.
What's the ability of the DNR to harvest, say, native plant seeds? If you know where they're at, do you have any restrictions on harvest for propagation of native plants on a state park, or are those, you can't pick them?
No, we currently manage about 10,000 acres of prairies in our state parks, a total historical prairie base of about 50,000 acres in state parks. Of that 10,000 acres, we've been had a restoration program for many, many years. We began prescribed burning in the 70s, and we now have some combines where we do harvest because we're concerned about having local seed source as we continue our restoration efforts in our parks across the system. So to answer your question, we do active harvest. We don't have a surplus right now where that seed can be used by others. We do some cooperation with our local area DNR teams, but for the most part, we're using the current seed that we harvest to restore additional prairie in our state park system.
Representative Hansen, as I read through this, and I hope you all will correct me if I'm wrong, you're doing adding about 400 acres a year in restored prairie. But if I looked at your rate, it would take 100 years to fully go back to your 50,000 original acres. Am I right about that?
That's correct. It's a long-term process, and the value of the seed that we currently collect in our state park system last year was $285,000, $863, so the replacement value. If we went to contract for prairie restoration, it would probably cost us $3,000 an acre. We've been able to do that for $500 or $1,000 an acre because we harvest our own seed, and we're looking at diversity, so we're harvesting grass seed or wildflower seed as well as grass seed for good diversity.
What you're doing seems just right on. However, the pace is incredibly slow given the fact that you have a gem. And because you have natives of a local ecotype, they are wild, and you put a monetary value on it, and I don't think anybody's done that before. I thought that was extremely telling about how valuable what you're doing is, but that's on the good side. On the bad side, moving it just 400 an acre over the next 100 and taking 100 years does not seem to be the correct pace. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to follow up on that, is the pace a result of staffing, or is it on what the resource will bear?
I would say primarily staffing and our allocation of dollars for that activity. We currently, out of our operating budget, allocate about $2 million towards resource management, and that probably covers about 20% of our need. So we could greatly enhance our efforts if we had additional resources to accomplish accelerated resource management.
One final follow up. Do you utilize CCC workers at all in the harvest?
Yes, the Minnesota Conservation Corps is critical to our the success of our resource management programs as well as our trail maintenance programs. So increases that we do get, we typically will leverage funds for our labor-intensive work, the Minnesota Conservation Corps and programs like Sentence to Service. So, yes, that's very important to our completing our projects.
Help us here in following up to that question. How much of the $2 million that you put in resource management is actually spent on CCC?
I don't have that figure here.
That would be a helpful figure for later.
Okay, we'll look into that. I do know that in the central region, we spent in the neighborhood of $50,000 on contracts with Minnesota Conservation Corps, but we'll get that information for you.
Yes, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just along the same line of questioning, so theoretically, if there was more Minnesota Conservation Corps workers available to you, either through your budget or some other means, that could expedite this process of reestablishing the native prairie or other conservation efforts you're working on?
That would be helpful, yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Director Hartek, you popped my ears up when you made the statement that the contract out of it cost, did you say $3,000 an acre to have it privately done? First, did I hear that right? And you're doing it currently for $400 an acre?
No, our estimate is $500 to $1,000 an acre, and our resource specialist has looked at some contracting, and he said a contract for a good diversity of grasses and prairie forbs would be $3,000 an acre. Yes.
Okay. I would ask that you have that person make the appointment with my office to clarify that he's out in left field in that. I'm aware of one that just got done in western Minnesota, privately done for well less than $1,000 an acre. We should review that because I'm not so sure that you shouldn't be looking at the opportunity to do that privately. So I'd appreciate if that would happen. And the next thing would be, are you selling any of the excess seed that you're harvesting on state land? And is it going outside the state? And do you have any intention of getting in the business like you are in the seedling business, of getting in the native seed business?
I think you might be referring to the Division of Forestry's program for tree seedlings.
I'm referring to the DNR is in the seedling business, and it's the forestry division. And I'm wondering if you guys are thinking about getting in the seeding business.
State parks are not at this point as far as selling prairie grasses or forbs.
Madam Chair,
is that
maybe I'll ask the assistant commissioner. You're not intending to possibly expand your movement in the horticulture business to include native prairies, and I'm just wondering if you're thinking it costs $3,000 in the real world to do it when it's way, way less than that. I would hate to think that you're looking at an opportunity here where you don't belong to go. Shouldn't be going.
Representative McNamara, I'm aware of your concerns. As you can see, and we can talk about our program activities related to native prairie seed collection, we need to do this to restore our lands and to do our land with prairie restoration work. I don't think we could produce enough seed to meet our needs and try to make it to sell any to anybody else for a long time. That would not be our intention. We need to restore our lands, and that's our highest priority at this point in time.
Representative McNamara, the super value, in my judgment, of what they are doing is they are using seeds that are totally local, that are wild, that grew up in the forests, and they're not moving them very far. So they are preserving Minnesota's genetic seed bank, if you will. And that is a high value because it's almost all gone. So when other people come in and bring in seeds, perhaps from someplace else, they're not doing the preservation that we require of our parks. And I think we have to say, good job, guys, for what you're doing. It's not fast enough, but good job in the way you are doing it. So I wouldn't want you to leave here with the notion that at least some of us think you're doing the right thing. Representative Moe, did you have a question?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that, we fully integrate our resource management program with our conservation education program. So we have a program at Wild River State Park that's called Prairie Care, where we'll get school kids that will help with seed collection, and we'll have prairie stewards who will collect forb seed for us, and then those students will be involved with processing the seed over the winter months, and then help scatter and sow the seed in the spring. So they're able to see start to finish the fruits of their efforts, and it's been a valuable education tool for our system and for the citizens of the state as well. With regard to our cultural and historic features, we're very fortunate that the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Works Progress Administration built a lot of our infrastructure. However, that also means that the trend is that we've got a very aging infrastructure. 1.5 million people visit historic sites in a given year. 38% of park land is on the National Register of Historic Places. It includes 1,600 buildings. 620 building structures and objects are on the historic register. And we currently allocate about 10% of our capital development resources to specifically to rehab our cultural resources, our historic and buildings and facilities. And
Representative Clark, did you have a question?
I believe you're on the cultural and historic features?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Hartog, I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask, but perhaps you could point me to the person who could. I'm aware of, well, first of all, can you remind the committee what the particular relationship of our Native American Minnesotans are to the park and access to the some of the cultural heritage that they have at stake in the park?
I'm not sure if I can comprehensively answer the question, but certainly at Mille Lacs Cap Hill State Park, our state park staff works very closely with the Mille Lacs Band to provide activities and ongoing partnerships in management. A number of our parks are within the 1854 treaty area, so when we have special deer hunts, we collaborate with them on setting quotas and discuss our management strategies with them before we have our special hunts in state parks within that 1854 treaty area. And that's parks like St. Croix State Park, where we have probably the second largest special deer hunt in the state next to Camp Ripley, and Wild River State Park as well. We work with the Indian bands on that. Up on the North Shore, we work with Fond du Lac and the Boys Fort Band. We're also, of course, one of the first parks in the nation that has a state park that's cooperatively managed at Grand Portage with the Grand Portage Band. So I'm not sure if that gets at your question. I think it related to a relationship generally with the Indian community. Or?
It does, and then, Madam Chair, just a follow-up to that. Can you speak specifically to the access guaranteed by those treaties to medicinal harvesting medicinal plants within the state park by Minnesota Native Americans?
Indian members are allowed access into the state parks without purchasing a permit to exercise their treaty rights for hunting, angling, and trapping. So it relates to allowing access for those elements that are protected by treaty. And medicinal plants, I'm not sure if that's one of those, so I can't speak to that.
No, Chair. I guess I would just request that you check on that and get back to me, because I'm aware of some concerns raised in the past year about that access and actually specific difficulties at Wild River State Park.
Okay.
So if you could check on that and we could see if we need to clarify that at all.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
On our, of course, we provided a wide variety of nature-based recreational opportunities, hiking, horseback riding. We've got 1,255 miles of multi-purpose trails, picnicking over 6,000 sites, camping over 5,000 sites. And you notice the camping trend when you look at our individual campers and our group campers. We're approaching 900,000, and that's up considerably from about 750,000 a number of years ago. We provide extensive angling opportunities at 52 water accesses and 27 fishing piers, and those are just within the state park system, and we have almost that number of accesses at our forest recreation sites. 3 million visitors take part in nature observation, and about 1.6 million per year engaged in birding.
Yes, Representative Dalby.
I have a question, Mr. Hartek, and I'm wondering, we're kind of running short on time here, but I was wondering regarding the interpretive part of state parks, and under our bullet points, that's one of our core functions is to preserve, restore, and interpret. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what, how many seasonal naturalists we have, for instance, today versus maybe 10 years ago, or full-time naturalists. How are we doing on the naturalist program? Because to most Minnesotans, that's what they see is the naturalist and the visitor center. You know, you see the pictures of the little kids in the in the pajamas going down to the naturalist program. It's very important to the residents of Minnesota. It's one of the things that they remember their entire lives. And I'm wondering how we're doing with that. And I'm talking about a population that maybe doesn't go on long trips or fly around the world, but these are people who spend their leisure time in our Minnesota state parks, and I think it's a population we really have to look at to serve well. And I'm wondering how our budget is looking as far as increasing that amenity for the people of Minnesota versus taking a cut.
We do have a $150,000 change level within the department, and so we will accelerate our efforts. And we haven't had interns or seasonal naturalists for a number of years that were paid out of our state general funds. We currently have 12 naturalists within the state park system, year-round naturalists. That includes one naturalist at Fort Snelling who's in charge of our Southeast Asian program, very successful program. And then we have one regional naturalist, which one in each of the four regions, and then we have a statewide coordinator. So we currently do not, last fiscal year, we did not have any seasonal naturalists or interns, again, that were funded out of our regular operating budget. Some of our naturalists were able to secure some grants and secure interns from under other funding sources.
Since you're going to be back next time and I see another question here, it would be helpful if you would bring a chart, kind of the history of the last 10 or 15 years of how many naturalists, how many, is that helpful?
That would be very helpful. Thank you, ma'am.
I think we're all concerned with one of the issues that you brought up about the changing demographics and what new what our new demographics are going to want out of our park. Mm-hmm. So that would be maybe helpful in getting to that question. With that, did that answer?
Madam Chair, quickly going back to the visual with 360 archaeological sites, do you know if any of those are Indian burial sites, mounds?
Some of those would definitely include that, yes.
I think if we can get up, is there anything you want to say to get through slide 11? We're about there now. Slide 13. So we can start with legislative initiatives when we...
Just in general, our conservation education program is critical, as you mentioned. It's a concern that we engage youth, and we can't afford to lose a generation of youth, connecting them with the environment and outdoor recreation and conservation education so they're comfortable enjoying the outdoors. And we're going to expand our efforts at reaching minorities and culturally and ethnically diverse people, and expand our visitor participation in resource management programs like the successful Prairie Care program that we had. We hope that state parks can be a venue to attract a whole bunch of new users to outdoor recreation in the state of Minnesota. Our parks are developed to provide for recreational opportunities, and in some cases more developed where urban folks might be more comfortable than in a wilderness setting. And once we get them out to the parks, I think they'll discover the wonders of nature and then gravitate to all kinds of other outdoor recreational pursuits that we have that help celebrate our heritage in Minnesota.
Thank you. Any final statement, Ms. Meyer, before we wrap up here and have start with your legislative initiatives next?
Madam Chair, members, I just want to say thank you. As we start talking about the parks budget, just remember, we'll go back to that, the beginning slide. Parks is one of our departments that is very heavily general fund based, and also they run on the receipts that they get as well. We're going to talk about statutory appropriation, budget change items. We will be able to talk more about what we want to do with that money, which includes the interpretive services and also outreaching to our demographical changes and needs that are out there. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Not a question, but one quick announcement, if I might. I'm sure everybody's remembering tomorrow night is the Mohawk Banquet, and I want to make sure everybody on the committee knows, and everybody in the audience knows. So if you have any questions, please see Representative Hansen. Thank you.
With that.